The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the program. Welcome to a new week, actually.
You hear that little squeak in my voice? I should not eat a brick of cheddar cheese right before the show, but I was just hungry. I had a little bit of soup earlier, and I had a bowl of cereal thinking that would tide me over. And then I just knew there was a brick of extra sharp cheddar cheese just sitting upstairs. So I went and grabbed it, and I ate it. So anyway, but we'll get through this. Welcome. I hope everybody had a great weekend. We had some fun on the Twitch channel over the weekend, and I always look forward to that. And I try to get all rested up by the time Monday rolls around so that we can get back into our serious mode, which is what we'll be doing tonight. In fact, tonight's show, I've been looking forward to for quite a while. Tonight's show, we'll be talking with David Ditchfield from England, in fact. He has to get up really early to do this, and we appreciate it. But we're going to be talking about his near-death experience, because not only was the near-death experience itself quite amazing, but the accident that occurred to bring it about was unbelievable. Wait till you hear this story. And then what happened to him after the near-death experience when he came back and started to live his life again. Also very, very amazing. He's now a motivational speaker as it relates to that experience. He's also an artist. He's a composer. And these are all things that he wasn't doing prior to this near-death experience. So it's going to be a fascinating discussion. I'm looking forward to it. We have an unbelievably dedicated group of people that join us almost every night, whether it's for the live program or it's for the podcast version or even watching the YouTube video the subsequent days of the program. We get a lot of eyes and ears, but we want more. So if you're part of that group who's listening and watching, please share the show with people that you believe will appreciate it as well. Your social media friends, whatever it happens to be, you know people that enjoy these particular topics. When you get an opportunity, please share links, please share pages, and let people know this show exists. We need to start spreading the word and getting more people to join us, regardless of the platform. We just want to have more. It's all about getting more. And I'm not greedy about it. I just think it's great for the guests to get more eyes and ears. So all good, but share it if you can. Thank you. The fuzz is on it. Love to see that. Anyway, let's see. What else do we need? Along those lines, let me just give you a couple quick web addresses. So, you know, the URL for the YouTube channel is just youtube.com/JV Johnson. You'll find it pretty easily there. And then, of course, the podcast version is available on all major podcast distribution systems. Very easy to find if you search for Beyond Reality Paranormal. That's the name of the podcast version of the show. And I think that's going to do it for our, you know, kind of our in getting into a new week monologue. And we'll go to break and then we'll bring our guest in. Again, tonight we're talking with David Ditchfield about his near-death experience. It's quite a story. You're not going to want to miss this. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the program, everyone. It's Beyond Reality. I'm still in the middle of this Hairmageddon. Funny thing about hair, it doesn't stop growing. And if you don't get it cut, it just keeps getting longer. It's really a very, very difficult situation to be dealing with. But we are dealing with it. And I'm told that the haircutting salons, places will be able to open in a few weeks. By then, we'll see what happens. We'll see how long the hair gets. Maybe by then I'll just keep it and we'll just go with the ponytail look. Who knows? Anyway, welcome back to the program, everyone. I promised for, in the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about having this guest on tonight, David Ditchfield. We've had other people. We've had people on the program who have shared their near-death experiences with us. This one is one of the most interesting, not just the experience itself. The aftermath is fascinating, and the events leading up to the near-death experience are just, they'll make you gasp. They're going to make you gasp and maybe have your jaw drop to the floor a little bit, but it's a great story, and we're really honored. David is in England. He's up very early to do this for us. David, welcome to Beyond Reality. It's such an honor to have you on.
Thanks for the lovely introduction.
It's my pleasure. I truly mean it. I heard your story on another program, and I immediately said, we've got to have David on to tell this story here. And I'm not sure where to start, but what I'd really like to do is get a sense of your life prior to all this. Give us just kind of a summary of what was going on in your life prior to all of this change.
Yeah, sure. I'd left school without any qualifications, and so I decided to move down to London and try and sort of cut a life out there for myself. And of course, like any major city, it's very hard to make ends meet. But I was picking up work, mainly sort of labouring work, as it were, and which was fine. But it was tough, and I was down on my luck, really. You know, I was hitting hard times. I was drinking heavily because, basically, the local bar was my office. That's where you go and when hustle for work, you know. So things were not really going too great for me. In all fairness,
you know, I don't want to tip our hand too early here, because I want to talk about the changes that occurred to you after the near death experience in a little bit. But just to set the stage here, were you a religious person prior to the experience?
No, not at all. No, it didn't enter my thought pattern. Really, I was just like living by the day, you know, just kind of like, if things went wrong in my life, you know, I just look for a quick fix rather than looking to any sort of faith. You know, when I say a quick fix, just, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I'll get over this. Let's go and have another beer down at the local bar, or just go and hang out with the guys. That was my way of fixing things. Yeah.
What about artistic ability? Did you consider yourself an artist or a musician or any of those things prior to this?
Well, no, I mean, but basically I was, when I'd moved to London, I'd started to teach myself guitar. And when I say guitar, it's like very basic sort of three chord wonder stuff, you know, I'd hooked up with a few bands then. I was, you know, we were trying to get gigs and trying to get record deals, but obviously, again, that's incredibly hard to get yourself through that keyhole. Yeah, and when I was at school, I enjoyed drawing and what have you, but I never took it any further because of my lack of qualifications. It's very tough in the UK to actually take things further. To get into art school, you actually need more than just the abilities of just being creative. You know, you've got to have all the, you know, English language is one of the first things you've got to get. Which seems odd to me, but there you go.
Yeah, and had you had any interaction with or experience with, or maybe even knew people that had some kind of near-death experience prior to this?
No, not at all. I'd never even heard of the phrase near-death experience, to be honest with you, until I'd actually had mine. And spirituality didn't really sort of come into my... It was not something that I was really aware of. It's not highly taught of in the UK, in all fairness, so... I got no idea about it whatsoever. Yeah.
And obviously that all changed very, very significantly. Tell us the story about the day that you had the accident, which led to all of this for you.
Sure. Well, the day of the accident, I'd been staying at my sister's. She could see I was going through hard times, and she said, come and stay with me and my family. They live in Cambridge, in the countryside. So I was hanging out there for a couple of weeks, and I just met a friend down in London, and we were getting on really great, you know. And so she said, oh, I'll come and stay with you for a couple of days. I said, that'd be brilliant. So she did, and we were hanging out together, and she had to get back to London. So I took her to the station, and we walked onto the platform, and the train pulled in, and the doors opened. So I helped her on with her bags. and we got onto the carriage, and I gave her a hug and a kiss to say goodbye. And then the emergency door indicator started buzzing, and I remember her saying, come on, you got to get off. I said, yeah, don't worry, I'm cool. As I stepped back, I was wearing like a three-quarter length sheepskin coat that day, and it got trapped in the bottom corner, right hand corner, just got trapped in the doors as they closed. So they slammed to, and there I was trying to pull this coat out. But it just wasn't happening. It just remained completely shoved in there, and I thought, oh no. I looked around and shouted for help, hoping that there would be a guard or somebody working, you know, for the station on the platform. But there wasn't. There was nobody else around apart from one other guy who was actually seeing off his partner. So I then started banging on the glass of the windows and hoping that somebody would run through working for the company, but nobody did. Then there's like these two buttons either side of the doors for open and close, you know. So I was hitting those. They didn't work. The engine started to rev up, and I thought, oh, you know, this is it. I'm going to die. I didn't think I was going to survive this because I knew that there was no way it was going to pull out. And so I remember looking into the eyes of my friend Anna, who I was seeing off that afternoon, and the look of fear in her eyes as she looked back at me. And I thought, this is really it. And the train started pulling out, and I lost my footing and was dragged along the platform at great speed. It's amazing how fast these trains pull out. You don't actually think about it until you're in that predicament. And then I lost my footing, and then I was dragged along. And then I figured at that point, maybe this is my last chance, that the body weight of myself might just release me, but it didn't. And I got pulled between the space of the platform edge and the train itself. And as it was going at great speed, I got sucked in, and down I went. And it was like being sucked into complete hell. I was thrown around like a rag doll. I was tossed from pillar to post. And it was incredibly painful. And I remember being completely conscious about the whole thing. So there was no, you know, there was no anaesthetic.
Wow.
There to,
for yeah. The natural.
Yeah, so it was very, very, very frightening. And then as I got thrown around so drastically and dramatically, I then suddenly hit the ground in between the tracks as the train continued to go over my head, as it were. Well, not literally over my head, but just, I mean, overhead.
So you were in between the rails. There's a rail on the right, rail on the left, and the train was right above you at that point?
That's it. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. So I was lying down there. And I figured, you know, it wasn't over yet, that part of the actual undercarriage of the train itself could just kind of whack me over the back of the head. So I just kept my head right down. And I remember just smelling the oil of the track and just hearing this train rattling at full speed over me. And eventually it moved on. And then it disappeared off down the track, and
they were completely unaware. Anybody in the engine or a conductor or someone, one of the employees, had no idea what had just happened.
No way, not at all. Yeah, I mean, my friend Anna told me afterwards she ran through from the carriage doors to look through a window to see if I'd been released, and she saw me go under. She said she saw me roll under. She said. And so she ran through the carriage to try and alert, you know, someone to stop the train. And she couldn't find. She eventually bumped into a ticket collector, and then she told him, and he was able to alert the driver. And she said it didn't stop till quite some time way in the middle of the countryside.
Wow. So when your coat first got caught in the door, and you were face to face basically with your friend, she recognized what was happening to you. You obviously must have started, maybe not panic, but certainly knew how dire that situation was. Was she screaming in the car for help or anything?
Oh, yeah. She was. She said that she was in a completely real state. She was just running through the carriage trying to, you know, ask for help. And then, you know, people were frantically trying to find, you know, the emergency stop buttons.
Yeah.
And it's funny because before my accident, there was all these ridiculous notices over the door saying, do not pull this lever, do not push that, otherwise you'll get fined. And, you know, so she would in a state of shock, she just panicked. And not only that, she wasn't that tall to be able to reach of the actual levers. So one of the good things to come out of all this a year later was that they changed 6 laws throughout the whole UK, you know, following my accidents, because of all things like that that obviously weren't properly put into place. So now it's a lot easier to be able to stop a train if there's something like this.
That's a bit of a silver lining, but what a price to pay. Now, I have to ask you, do you think that if the train had stopped while you were attached to it, that may have been an even worse situation, possibly?
That's a good point. I never thought of that. You're probably right, you know, yeah. I don't think it would have been able to have stopped anyway in time. It's like an ocean liner,
yeah.
Isn't it? It takes them a mile to stop or whatever, you know. But, you know, I think really it was just more that she needed to alert and stop them, you know. But it's a natural instinct, isn't it? You know, your friend's just gone under the train. You don't just sit there and think, well, that's just happened. You know, you want to stop the train. So, in fact, she told me afterwards, when they did eventually stop, she said there was this stillness. So they sat in the middle of the countryside and she was like, and obviously completely distraught, and she turned around to the carriage of commuters and said, look, my friend's just gone under the train, and I'm sure he hasn't survived. Can we say a prayer for him? And she said that a lady stepped forward and said, look, I'm a Christian, would you like me to take the prayers? And she said, that'd be great. So she said, like, this whole carriage of people who were commuting put down their laptops, their newspapers, and they all prayed for me. And yeah, so I felt that energy actually coming from them.
I was just going to say, we're going to need to revisit that point when we get into the near-death experience part of this discussion. But obviously this was a really good quality coat that you couldn't rip it, or you couldn't dislodge it. If it was sheepskin, it was probably quite strong. Mm-hmm. But I imagine you were trying to take it off.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I didn't. I'd like to have done is what I should have said. But because of the quality of it, the sheepskin, was no lining down the arms, if you like. So there was no sort of silk or satin lining, you know. It was just like sheer sheepskin that was like attached to my, I was wearing like a sweater, a jumper underneath. So I knew that I wouldn't be able to pull it off. In fact, the guy I told you about, he was stood there. He was shouting at me saying, take your coat off, mate. Take your coat off.
And
I just thought, there's no way. Because it's really odd, because even though the whole thing happened in seconds from the moment it took off and I went under, it felt like minutes. I felt like I got time to think things through. I went into what is called survival mode, basically, where my mind was able to process what was going on. And although I was completely terrified, there was a part of me was actually thinking through, right, what to do next. And I'd remembered, I'd seen this news item about two, three weeks earlier on the TV, where a small child had been thrown from a burning apartment block. And that child had survived. And they said the reason is because infants don't tense up. You know, they're all relaxed and stuff. And so, whereas adults, the older you get, the more you tense up. So I thought, right, that's my only chance here, is to actually just relax and just, like, you know, try and be like a child and like that infant. And so, you know, all those different things I could think through in my head. In fact, my friend Anna said to me when she came to visit me in hospital, she said, look, this is really weird and I don't want to freak you out. She said, but when I saw you go under that train, you went under with such grace. and I laughed and I said, you know what it is? And then I told her the story. I said, it's because I'd relaxed myself. And so, you know, there's something to be said for that. I mean, I discovered actually only recently, I was watching a TV. In fact, my friend told me, he said, what's this program? There's this guy, he's an American guy, and he does lots of research into the brain and how it works. And apparently he was talking about that, and he said that sometimes when people are facing death, you know, that happens, that the mind it doesn't slow down. Time doesn't slow down, but it gives you, you've got this sort of ability to be able to process what is about to happen to you. So that's quite interesting.
How long was the accident experience from the point where your coat got caught in the door, you recognized what was going on, to the point you were lying between the tracks and the train had moved on? What's the time frame of that?
Well, according to the rail police, because the UK rail police did a massive inquiry on it, and they said that it took 13 seconds from the point of the train actually leaving to me going under.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I know, but that felt more like, you know, like it was 5 minutes.
Right, right.
So there you go. But, and then obviously the train moved on, so that's going to add about another sort of 10 seconds, I guess, by the time it's moved on. But, you know, in my mind, it was a heck of a lot longer. You know, it just felt like a huge ordeal. When I was actually pulled in, as I say, when I was tossed around all over the place, it felt like I was been thrown into a washing machine on full spin. Mm. And it felt like that full spin was continuous for quite some time, yeah.
You're lying between the tracks. Train has moved over you and past you. Were you conscious or were you unconscious at that point?
I was completely conscious, yeah. I never lost any consciousness at all. So, yeah, I was very, very alert. And so, yeah.
Were you still in pain? Or I assume, and unfortunately I haven't experienced anything like this, maybe your brain cuts it all off.
Yeah, well, I think it does to a certain extent. I think it's like if you were in a physical fight. I think if like a boxer, I think the first punch really hurts, but I think once the match goes on, you know that you don't feel any more punches, and well, you do, but you don't feel them quite so intensely. And so, yeah, the pain was there, but it was all mixed in with a complete sort of you know. I mean, I've thought about it quite a bit, and I figured, in fact, one of my consultants turned around to me and said, "Do you know what you went through? I don't think anybody could actually process what it's like to experience something like that, and I don't think any scientist would actually be able to answer it either. The mind and the body is not used to being thrown into such trauma, you know, and it was a lot to deal with. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like it's hard to just explain it. Like, yeah, it was painful and it was frightening. There was lots and lots of mixed emotions and fears and feelings all going on all at once, and it was all very intense in such a short space of time.
What were you thinking? I mean, you're lying there, you're conscious, and what state was your body in?
It was pretty bad. It's pretty ripped up. My coat was now shredded to pieces as the train had moved on, because I looked and I looked at the left arm. There was nothing left of that coat, and also my left arm had been cut off from the top end, so from the elbow down, so that had been severed.
From where? From what point of the arm was severed?
From the arm, from the elbow.
From
the elbow. Yeah. So and that was pretty messy, and I could see the inside of my arm. And it's interesting because, yeah, it was horrible and it was frightening, but there was a part of me was kind of strangely fascinated to be able to see I remember looking and thinking, wow, that's the inside of my arm. That's the inside of me. it's a strange concept that it's being in that position was horrible, but it wasn't as bad as the anticipation. I mean, I'd say that just facing it all, death, you know, facing death in the face was incredibly horrific. But I think the anticipation would have been worse. If somebody had said to me 10 minutes before, right, you're going to go under the train, I'd be like, what? But when you do it, I guess, like I say, it's survival. So there's a part of you actually braves up to it as well.
Well, obviously you did. You were lying there, but you didn't. Stay there. Paramedics or rescue team came in. What happened?
That's right. Yeah. I remember the first thing I did was try to get my cell phone out of my pocket to phone for help. But obviously that wasn't working anymore. And And then, but they arrived really fast actually, because I didn't realize, but there was a hospital just around the corner. So they were there really quick and they jumped down onto the track and, you know, started cutting through the rest of my clothes to you know, get some of the injuries and stuff. And then I don't know how they did it, but they managed to get me on a stretcher and then they managed to get me up onto the platform, which was a good 6 feet drop, you know. And then they you know, wheeled me into an ambulance. And I remember getting in the back of the ambulance and the doctor turned around to me and said, look, you're in a pretty bad way. And he said, but there is a hospital around the corner, but there's a much better one that will save you. Can you hang on? I said, yeah, let's go. So I remember the siren going on and we just kind of like screamed down the highway. Yeah, it was like a rocket taking off. And there we were. And we pulled into the hospital and there was a whole team of people waiting for me there in the emergency department because they'd obviously phoned ahead and to let them know what had happened. And then, you know, there I was, and there was doctors frantically running around, you know, yeah, and trying to save me basically at that point because I was losing a lot of blood. Yeah.
David, you're in the hospital at this point. You, you're having work done on you. You are, tell us what's going on around you and what you're being told. And at some point, obviously, you are no longer conscious. Let's figure out how this happens.
Yeah, sure. Well, I was still in the emergency department, and at that point, and as I say, the doctors were frantically running around trying to save me. And at that point, the main consultant came in, who took care of me, and he was reassuring me. He said, "We're going to save you. Don't worry. Just hang in there." And he said, "We're going to take you straight into theatre once we're ready and operate on you." And I said, "Okay." And then I remember he came over to me and he said, "Look, your family are here. They've arrived." And I went, "Really?" And I thought, "Wow, that seemed really quick." And he said, "Would you like to see any of your family?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How many can you handle?" I said, "Just send them all through. You know, whoever's here, that's great." Because I really wanted, I felt like I needed them there at that point. And so they came through, and I remember my parents came over, and my mother was in tears, you know, and she came over, she was holding my hand, and I was going, "Mom, I'm so sorry. It's always me causing all the dramas in this family," because my life up until that point had been like that. I was making one mistake after another, you know. And even though the accident wasn't my fault, I just felt like I was to blame for, you know, bringing even more stress to everyone. But she was going, "No, don't please, you know, don't apologize. We're just so, you know, you're alive, and it's just, I'm just so happy you're alive. Just don't worry." And then I was very keen to see if Anna was amongst everybody, because I was obviously, she'd just seen it all
right
happen, and I just wanted to talk to her, check she was okay. And there she was, sat right at the back. And so I said, "Can I speak to Anna, please?" And so she stepped forward and she came over. And I remember she just stood there looking at me and just shaking her head in disbelief. She just kept doing that, you know, and she was going, "I can't believe you're alive." And I said, "Yeah, well, I know." She said, "Well," she said, "because I saw you go under," and she said, "but then when we got to the next station, eventually we all had to get off and the platform was packed, you know." And she said, "I heard this announcement over the system saying, apologizing for delays, but there'd been a fatality at the last station."
Oh,
so
wow,
that was confirmation for her that I'd gone, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I just really felt for her. It's odd, because even though I was going through, all I was concerned about at that point was her and her well-being, because I thought she needs, you know. So there was also this kind of connection between us, because we'd been through something so traumatic together, you know. There was this bond that was there. But it was at that point that I was lying there that I suddenly left that hospital. I left all the trauma, the pain, all the noise and you know, and the bright lights, and I went to this beautiful darkened room, and what it felt like a room, and I was lying there, and what I realized was that I was now lying on something completely different than the hospital trolley. And I looked, and it was like a huge piece of slate. It was like a big, like sort of like medieval altar, you know. And I was lying on this huge rock, And you'd think that would be uncomfortable, but on the contrary, it was like a very comfortable place to be, lying there. And I just looked around me to see where I was, and there were like these orbs that were pulsating all around me, and all these beautiful colours, like yellows and oranges and greens. And it calmed me just seeing all these pulsating lights. And at that point, I figured straight away that I was dead. I thought, I've died, and this is where you go to next. And there was no sense of fear or regret or panic, or it was just I went with it. I was really, you know, I was okay. I was happy with the state that I was in, because it was such a beautiful, calming place. And then I felt there was a presence nearby with me. You know, I felt like somebody was there with me. So I looked around, and just stood at my feet was this androgynous being, like this beautiful being, and with like this kind of like white blonde hair and this skin that was like radiating light from within. And this being of light was it's like a person just stood there wearing like a very contemporary black t-shirt, you know, nothing too ethereal, just something quite that I could connect with. And
you were still on the slab at this point?
Yeah, I was still lying on this kind of...
And this being was at your feet. Okay.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. The being stood at my feet. And I remember just looking. I couldn't take my eyes off this beautiful face, because there was like a knowing expression. Like I'd known this being all my life and beyond. It was like there was a strong connection between us. And there was this reassurance coming, radiating from the being. And her eyes, or his eyes, were just like smiling at me, you know, just... as if to say, keep calm, you know, everything's going to be fine. And so I did keep calm. I just lay back, and I thought, hang on, the pain's gone. There's no more pain. So I looked down at my body, and it was completely, there was no wounds whatsoever, not even a scratch. Everything was fixed, you know, and I realized I was no longer clothed, but I was just covered in like this blue sort of satin sort of silky sheet, which kept me really relaxed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lay back, I put my head back onto the slate, and as I did, I looked up, and what I saw above me were like these three grids of light that were kind of closing in on me. And the light that was coming from these grids was just beautiful, pure white light. And I just couldn't take my gaze away from that light, because it just felt so calming and peaceful. And it was the intensity of that light I wouldn't be able to look into normally, you know, like an electric light or a sunlight, because right, it would be just too much for the eyes. But here it was fine. And here it felt completely captivating to just keep looking into this light. And then I suddenly felt this energy that was coming from the androgynous being had suddenly sort of had gone up in intensity, as it were. And I looked, and there were two more beings either side of me in a female form. One was like sort of brown hair and long brown hair and brown eyes, and they're wearing a contemporary dress.
Were human looking? Was it undefined?
Yeah, very much so.
They were very human.
No, okay. Very much human. In fact, the female being to my left, her appearance was American Indian, Asian Indian, and looked to her. Hmm. And so there was a very much, I could tell the difference, you know what I mean? So, yeah, they were very human in form. But you could tell that they weren't human as well. You know, there was something different about them. There was just, and there's something about the whole place, it being there was as clear as you and I are talking now, and I'm the place I'm sat, you know, it was real, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a dream form, it wasn't chaotic, it was very well sort of it was like ultra real, I guess, you know. And these beings, even though they looked like human, I could tell that they weren't. So they were hovering their hands over my body, as it were, and there was this energy coming from their hands that was just like, it was almost like they were healing me. Well, they were healing me, but It felt more like they were healing my soul as opposed to they were healing my actual physical body. Because what the power that was coming from their hands was it felt like love. It felt like this really strong, unconditional love that was just like coming through. And it was just like, and it was a remarkable feeling, a sensation that was just, it was all the feelings of love I'd ever encountered in my life, either through different lovers or through my parents or my brother and sister or what have you, you know, and it was all there and it was all just condensed and coming through these beings. And it was a tremendous feeling. Yeah. So.
Wow. That's, I mean, you the way you describe it, and again, we've talked to other folks who've had near-death experiences, and there's this common thread that goes through the stories, and love is a word that comes up all of the time. Frequently, we'll hear words like knowledge, but love's always part of it. Where's the love coming from, do you think? Do you think the love is coming from inside of you and it's being realized, or do you think that there's some divine source of the love that is basically embracing you in this moment?
It's definitely the second. That's great what you just said there, by the way. Brilliant, both analogies. But it's the second one, really. It's a divine force, a divine energy where the love is coming from, which I was later to discover. I remember at the next point, I thought to myself, I started thinking about my family because I knew that they were already distraught down in the hospital.
Sure.
So I figured I'd try and I thought I'm going to see how they're doing. And so I kind of, all the feelings of guilt that it was all my fault that were gone, by the way, all that had disappeared. That's an interesting thought as well for me. I was up there, that had gone. All, you know, all those kind of emotions that are attached to you that don't belong to you just disappear. And I just thought, oh, I'll just check on them. So I looked over the edge of this huge slate rock, hoping to see them down in the hospital. But I couldn't see them at all. But what I did see was this remarkable sight. It was just—it was like a huge waterfall, but it was a waterfall of stars, and all these stars were just, yeah, I know, wow. It was remarkable. They were just cascading over the edge. And if you think of, like, say, Niagara Falls, you know, it was like that, but multiplied by tenfold, you know. And they were just going, and there was shooting stars falling through in the middle. And I looked right down, and I could see into infinity. It was just disappearing into one galaxy, into another. And there was, like, as I looked, the further down I looked, the more color I could see. And it was just a remarkable sight. And I thought, wow, I'm not in a small darkened room at all. I'm actually in the universe itself. You know?
Right.
So I just pulled my head back over again, and again, as I say, I didn't feel any sense of guilt or too much worry. I just thought, oh well, I'll catch up with them later. I'll be seeing them at some point. You know,
I mean, there are two timelines here. One is what you're experiencing as you've just described to us, and then there's another clock, an earthly clock of a period of time that you were either in surgery or whatever it was, and you were completely unconscious. And which allowed your spirit to have this near-death experience. Do we know what the time, like, first of all, how long did it seem like this was going on to you as it was happening? And secondly, do we know what the window was of the amount of time that you were actually unconscious?
Yeah, well, I wasn't actually unconscious when I had the near-death experience. I hadn't gone into theatre at that point. I was still in the emergency department. So, which is interesting because that means I can give you a rough time limit, and it would have been minutes that it went on for. But, you know, in the near-death experience itself, it was like time, like I was talking about it before, like, you know, it's a different realm.
Right.
Time doesn't come into it, and it felt like an eternity. And so I couldn't turn around and say, yeah, it felt like I was there for 10 minutes or whatever, or an hour. It just really didn't come into it. And it didn't even, you don't even think about time. You're just there, and you're just experiencing everything that's going on in such a relaxed manner that you just forget about all things like that. So it's hard to, you know, all I can say, it was more like an eternity rather than minutes. What it would have been in real terms.
Yeah. What came next for you, though? Were you then, I mean, at some point you recognized you were being pulled back to your body, or did that come later?
That came just later, yeah. What came next was the biggest part of it all and the biggest realization for me, because there was a lot of the knowledge that was coming through. It was all through telepathy and learning as I went along. And I remember turning over at that point, realizing that I would see my family later, as I figured. And as I turned over, I suddenly saw this remarkable vision. Well, not vision. It was a sighting right ahead of me. It was this huge tunnel of white light that was slowly drawing in towards me. And this tunnel of white light was surrounded by flames, very dramatic, beautiful flames that were just rotating round and circling. And even though they were very powerful flames, they didn't at all frighten me or alarm me. And I felt very calmed by all this. And the energy that was just so intense. And I knew straight away, I just said to myself, this is the source of all creation. This is God, you know. This is not the vision of God that we're all brought up to believe, you know, as we see on the ceiling of the Vatican, you know, the guy with the beard.
Right.
This is it, you know, this is God.
You're convinced that was God.
I was totally convinced, yeah. I knew it was, and I still do. And then the interesting thing is, you were talking about earlier about whether you thought that, you know, the healing that was coming through was it. And there you go. That was the main source of energy. That source of love was coming from there, and it was coming through these beings. They were like basically transmitting that love that was coming from this divine light.
Wow.
Yeah.
As you were moving towards the light and the flame and God, were the beings traveling with you, the three that were with you early?
I wasn't, you know, at that point, I wasn't really, you know, it was just, I was just so transferred, you know, I was fixed onto this light, and they hadn't dispersed as such, would have been with me. They were still there sort of healing me. But what I do remember at that point was I laid my head back, and I remember I was kind of like filled with so much happiness and joy. And I put my head back, and at that point, that's when I suddenly came crashing back down to earth, you know, and I was back in the hospital and you know, back into my body, and all the pain came rushing back immediately. And, you know, all the anxiety that was going on around me, the noise, you know, the lights, it was all very, it was like overkill.
Before you came crashing back to your body, and I think you mentioned this when you first started the story, you assumed you were dying. You assumed this was death. But obviously, it didn't bother you. You were actually in a very loving place, a very welcoming place. And if that had been death at the time, if it was permanent or whatever death is, it doesn't sound like it would have bothered you.
Not in any sense whatsoever. You know, I was in full acceptance of it. And in all fairness, I actually felt probably the happiest I'd felt for most of my life, because my life up until that point had been quite traumatic. It just hadn't worked out for me. It was constantly going wrong, and I was filled with a lot of guilt and remorse about the way my life had gone, and all those feelings had dispersed. So I just felt great. You know, I was really happy I was.
And when you came crashing back into your body, the pain came back, but your awareness came back. Were you aware enough to, A, recognize what had just happened, but secondly, to be a little saddened that you had come back?
I was totally aware of what had just happened, and I didn't feel sad that I'd come back, funnily enough, because I was just so charged with it that I just felt, wow, I've just got to tell the world what's just happened, and why have they sent me back? And I just wanted to tell everybody about it, you know. In fact, they were just about to wheel me into theatre, and then my family just came over to say goodbye, and then Anna came over, and I said, Anna, I've got something's just happened. It's really important. I've got to tell you about this. And she just put her hand over my mouth, and she said, tell me later, you know, not now. But it was like, no, I've got to tell you. This is really amazing, you know. And so that's how charged I was throughout. And when I came through after the eight-hour operation that they did on me, I remember I was in a lot of pain, and I was just suddenly the whole, you know, the shock of what had just happened, the actual physical, you know, and mental shock of the accident had kicked in. But I was still charged with all this, wow, you know, what about that? That's just this. It had changed my life at that point, literally. So yeah, there was no real sadness about coming back.
Give us a sense of what was going on physically here. Your arm was basically severed, but were they able to save it?
Yeah. That's interesting, actually, because just as they were weaning me in, I turned around to the consultant who'd been really caring, and I just said, look, I said, will you save my arm? Will you please save my arm? And he said, we'll do what we can. And he stuck to his word, because he just started working at the hospital. He was a young doctor, and bless him, he was determined. And it took like three major operations, 3 8-hour operations to save it, but it kind of like... He was enjoying, the fact that I wanted to do this, right. And I wanted to work at it, So they did, yes. Yeah. So they managed to save it. I mean, it doesn't function completely as it was, but I've still got it. I mean, there was a lot of hard work to get things moving again, but it can be done.
Sure. And if you don't mind me asking, answer what you want to answer, but don't if you don't. But were there any other long-term physical effects from the accident?
Well... Yeah, it's just all. I mean, that was the major one to deal with. But I mean, it just knocked everything out of sync. I mean, I'm just not the same person that I was. I can walk and I can. Thankfully, I can. I'm not wheelchair bound. Bless people who are. But I'm able to get around. I'm fine. But I'm just not. I haven't got that same spring in my step that I once had. So it knocks it out of you, and it knocks every single part of your body into. I've been. I had to do a lot of physio to get everything moving again and stuff. So, but also mentally, it knocks a lot out of you. I had to eventually have some therapy to sort of deal with that, deal with the trauma of what had happened. Because for a while I couldn't drive anymore, and I felt, well, the only way I can get around is by train, and I felt trapped.
Oh boy, yeah.
So it was a real sort of catch 22. So I had a lot of therapy to help me to try and deal with getting out and, not being scared of, you're fearful of the world. It's just going too fast and too furious. And so there was a lot of therapy to get me to be able to deal with that again. So,
and
yeah.
I think I failed to ask, and maybe you mentioned it, but when did all this occur? How many years ago?
Yeah, it was 2006 that it
2006,
occurred.
Okay.
Yeah, February, yeah.
Tonight we're talking, however, with David Ditchfield about his near-death experience, his accident that led to it, what happened during the near-death experience itself, and now we're going to get into what has happened since, because it's a remarkable transformation in many ways. His book outlines the entire journey. It's called Shine On, The Remarkable Story of How I Fell Under a Moving Train, Journeyed to the Afterlife, and the Astonishing Proof I Brought Back with Me. David, in that title, you say the astonishing proof I brought back with me. Let's talk about some of that proof. What changed? What happened when you came back and things started to calm down and you started to recognize not everything was the same?
Well, as I say, before I'd never heard of near-death experiences at all. So I figured... I was the only person that this had actually happened to at that point. So I felt, well, what is my mission? I've got to do something here. I've got to tell the whole world about that, the fact that death is nothing to fear, that there's a beautiful place that awaits us all. And I also wanted to try and record it in some way, So I remember my sister coming in to see me the very next night, and they'd given me my own room in the hospital, so it was nice that I'd got that space to myself. And we were chatting, and I remember it being very quiet and calm. And just as she was leaving, she said, look, is there anything I can get you when I come see you tomorrow? I said, yeah, can you get me a small sketch pad and a pencil? Because I wanted to try and record this and paint it. I got it in my mind that I was going to have to paint this. That was the best way to show people. And... I'd never done anything like this before in my life. But
yeah,
you weren't
a painter prior to this, right?
No, not at all. Not in no way whatsoever. I'd painted a few walls and floorboards and stuff. But basically, I just got it in my head. I thought, I've got to do a huge canvas. I wanted to do something like a big Michelangelo-style, Renaissance painting, to show everybody what I'd seen, because it was so huge and so powerful. I thought that's the only way I'm going to be able to do it, is on a big piece of canvas. So she bought that she said, yeah, okay, I'll bring your sketch pad in. So she did, and the nurses managed to prop me up because I could hardly move at all. In fact, I couldn't move at that point. And they propped me up, and I did this very faint sketch in this little pad, and which I've still got. You can barely see it, but it was this the outline sketches to my very first painting that I did. And so that was, yeah. So I couldn't wait to sort of get myself fit and strong enough to be able to start on this painting. And once I was physically well enough, I remember my aunt had come over from Canada to visit, and I was telling her all about it. So she went out and bought me a canvas, and it was quite a big one, which was great. And so I remember having it leaning against the wall at my sister's house where I was recuperating. And I kept looking at it, and I was apprehensive to start it because I thought, where do I start, you know? And also, I didn't want to mess this up, you know. I wanted to tell the world in the best possible way what I'd seen and what I'd experienced.
How vivid were those visions of the experience you had very, you know, recent to that, this near-death experience of the beings, all that? Was it really vivid in your mind at that point still?
Oh, yeah, totally. It was incredible, and still is. I mean, you know, I was scared that I was going to lose that vision, because it's like that's the difference between this and dream state. Like, for example, if you have a very powerful dream, dreams are more chaotic and bizarre, and they start to diminish with time. Whereas with the near-death experience, it's not a dream, and so it stays with me as vivid today as it was then. So there was no real fear for me. I didn't need that little sketch pad and pencil at all, you know. But that's my human mind taking over, saying I'm going to forget all this. But I didn't do it again. And so once I did actually start painting it, I could remember exactly how everything looked, and so I was able to start putting it onto this canvas. So I was incredible.
Sorry, it's okay. I'm just wondering if you feel now or felt then that maybe your hand was being guided by, whether it was God or those beings, you know, as you're painting and never had painted before and turning out these really incredible pieces of art that tell the story of your experience, do you think you were being guided in some way?
I was most certainly being guided. Once I started painting, it all started coming together really quick and really well, and I was really shocked. You know, I was apprehensive, but once I started putting paint onto that canvas, it was like, wow. I'd finish at the end of each day, and I'd look at it, and I'd think, that's remarkable. You know, that's not me. I can't have done all that. And I started to realize that I was actually what I call channeling through, not right. just through my hands, but through my whole being, you know.
Right.
And that was helping me to sort of create. And it's almost like I was being given like a crash course lesson of the highest quality of how to paint, you know, how to create a fine art, you know, painting, and how to use color, you know, and how to use color to bring out tones in skin and all different things like that. So yeah, it was amazing, and I still do whatever I do now. I'm still aware that I'm channeling through from the other side, because especially at the beginning as well, I felt like there was a part of me that was still connected to this other place I'd been. It's not like I'd just been sent back and that was it. There was a connection between me and that place. And so I felt that, you know, I was being helped.
After you had completed maybe the first painting, or, you know, as you completed these paintings, were you able to look at them and say, that's exactly what I wanted to portray? I mean, was it that rewarding for you?
Yeah, totally. You know, I felt completely happy with each one that I was painting, because it was stuff was appearing on the canvas that I didn't even realize.
Wow.
Was starting, you know, especially when I started painting the tunnel of light and the flames that were all appearing around, you know, there was each one that I did, and I started seeing things that I thought, where did that come from? How come it was almost like a happy accident, if you like, would happen on the painting? And then I'd look at it, and it was interesting, because quite recently a friend of mine got in touch with me, and she said, have you seen the latest images from the Hubble, you know, sort of telescope that have been photographing way beyond galaxies? And I was going, no. She said, they're just like your paintings. I was going, wow, let's have a look. So I looked, and she was right. So it was incredible. There was like these, they looked like like the flames that I talked about that were, you know, that surrounding the actual tunnel of light that looked like my painting. It was just remarkable. So, yeah.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, if people go to your website, they can see some of these works of art that you have created, yeah. Right? I mean, you do have them on the website.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. If you go on there, it's all on there. You know, I've got my paintings on there. Also, on my Instagram page as well, I tend to rotate my paintings around on there. So yeah, but if you go to the website, everything's on there, you know. So.
And it wasn't just paintings, David, right? I mean, you've realized suddenly that you had the ability to compose pieces of music. In fact, I think even complete symphonies, which is no small feat or small task.
Absolutely, yeah. that was the next thing that happened. It was interesting because I wanted to find this little spiritualist church that was in the town where I was staying, because I'd been told, 2 months prior to my accident, I'd bumped into some people on the training when I was coming up to visit my sister's family, and they said they were going to see this medium, and they said, why don't you come along? And I, obviously at that point in my life, I wasn't interested, but the lady who was sat opposite, she was quite insistent on it. She said, this woman is brilliant and nobody knows of her, come along. So she gave me this flyer and I put it in my pocket, forgot all about it. But for some reason, I went that night, and I went along. And while I was sat in this packed little spiritualist church, everyone was like getting messages from their loved ones who'd passed on. I wasn't looking for any message at all, but I got one. And she turned around to me, the medium. She said, gentleman in the blue sweater, your life is about to change. Be ready for it.
Oh, wow. You know?
Yeah. I know. And I said, I was thinking, what, it's going to be the lottery winning or the relationship I was after, you know. And I said, in what way? She said, and she stops, and she was like talking to them in her mind. And she said, they're not telling me. They're just saying it's going to be big, be ready for it, and you will be protected. So I knew then that's what it was all about. So I needed to find this place to try and track down this medium to talk to her, you know. Yeah. So when I walked, I eventually found it, and I went to one of their meetings. And when I was there, you know, at the end of the church meeting, they turned around to me and we had coffee and that, and they said, you look pretty in a bad way, and we know all about you. We saw you on the news. You know, you're the guy who went under the train, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And they said, we do spiritual healing here. I said, fantastic. So I started having spiritual healing. And through those healing sessions, the healers are like mediums, some of them, and they would give you like messages themselves, only small ones. They'd just say, oh, I was picking up, you know, usually things like, you've had a stressful week and blah, 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 and they're telling you to calm down. But what they kept saying to me was, one of them was saying, why am I seeing a violin placed across your chest? And I said, I've no idea. And then a few of them kept saying, you're going to write some music. I was going, okay. And they said, you're going to write some music about your experience. So I figured at that point it would be a 3-minute song, because that's what, as I say, I'd played in a few sort of punk rock and bands. So I went home, couldn't play the guitar anymore because my arm was still bashed up. So I pulled this old synthesizer out of the cupboard, started playing around on that, and this chord progression came together. But I thought, this is not actually going to be a 3-minute punk song. This sounds like it should be played by an orchestra. So I kept developing it up. And I'd become friends with a cello player in the local orchestra. And I had coffee with her one day, and she said, how's it going? And I told her what I was up to. And I said, yeah, I'm writing this new piece of music. I said, it sounds like it should be played for orchestra rather than played by a band. And she said, oh, maybe we'll do it one day. And I thought, right, I'm going to hold you to that. And so I just worked on it. And then my brother turned around to me. He lived down in London. And he said, look, I've got this packages that you can have, like an app you can attach to your laptop, and when you play your synthesizer, the notes that you play, that it can transpose it into notation,
right?
And so that's exactly what I did, and then I printed off all the parts. I started hearing different sounds, different instruments, you know, like the flutes in my head and horns, and then I started to understand what those different horns were. They were French horns and piccolos and what have you. So I got it all scored up, and then I contacted my friend. I said, "Do you remember that day when we had that coffee?" She said, "Oh yeah." I said, "Well, look, I've actually got this first movement together for a piece. Would you look at it?" She said, "Yeah." So she met me with one of the leaders of the orchestra, and they looked at it together, and they said, "Okay, we'll do it." So they offered to perform it, and that was remarkable because they said, "Oh, yeah, you know, there I was." But again, I was being channeled while all this stuff was coming together, all the ideas that were coming. By then, I was like, I knew that what channeling was, so I went along with it, and before I knew it, I was turning up to a rehearsal, and that was quite an amazing experience because part of me was very apprehensive because, you know, walking into into a rehearsal. You know, orchestras are very sort of highly educated, middle class sort of people, and I was a working class guy, and with no knowledge of music. So I was, you know, yeah, I was fearful, but I was also felt that I got this energy that was giving me strength as well. So I walked into the room, and then the conductor turned around and said, "Oh, the composer's here." I was going, "Composer?" Yeah. And then he said, "David, would you like to say a few words about your piece?" And so I turned around and said, "Well, no, that's fine. You guys just go ahead." He said, "No, come on." So I started talking about it. And of course, it was about my near-death experience. And once I started telling the story, I got this, again, this energy was coming through, and I was being protected. I was given the power to let my voice come out and tell all these people that I was once fearful of. And they all listened, and they were all asking questions, and it was great. And then I'll never forget the moment the strings came in, the opening strings, and it was like, wow. You know, it was like it took me back to that first moment in my apartment when I was playing this little synthesizer. And there it was. In full, like, three-dimensional sound. It was just incredible. You know, it's a beautiful experience to hear something that you've had inside you just come out from an orchestra. And, yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
It is amazing. You know, I just want to take you back to something here for a second, because I mentioned before that we're going to have to come back to it. When the people on the train, after the train stopped, and your friend Anna thought that, you know, knew that you had gone into the train and probably assumed the worst, and she asked everybody to pray, and they did. Do you think that had anything to do with what ultimately happened to you?
What, you mean the actual near-death experience?
Do the people, that group of people praying for you and to you and about you at that moment, do you think that that maybe opened some doors that led you to having that experience? Do you think it had anything to do with it?
I don't actually feel that. What I felt was I actually felt the energy coming from them, and because I needed it as I was literally losing so much blood and I was in a lot of trauma and pain. So I think that the prayers that they were sending me were helping me, giving me strength to hang on in that ambulance ride, and because that would have been the point that they were all praying.
I see.
Because I also know that I remember my parents coming in one day when I was in hospital, and I said, "Do you know what? There's about three or four churches in the surrounding sort of neighborhoods that are all praying for you because you've been on the news nearly every day." And I said, "I can feel that energy. I can feel those prayers." And I could. So I firmly believe in the power of prayer, and the power of prayer was just literally giving me that strength to be able to see me through the hard times of what I'd just been through. So I don't actually feel like it was actually, you know, helping me to experience what I did in the NDE itself, but I think it helped me greatly sort of in my recovery.
Since you had the near-death experience, do you find that you have a bit of a strengthened connection to other people who have had near-death experiences? Have you noticed anything different in that sense?
Yeah, well, it's especially quite recently, I've been talking to various other people, especially in the US as well, actually, who've had near-death experiences themselves through doing various interviews and stuff. It's great, you know, because we'll be chatting on air like you and I are chatting now, and then once we switch off, we both have a little natter afterwards, and we're all going, "Did you feel this when you were in the hospital?" There's all these different things, even though our near-death experiences were slightly different, the stories are all different, but there's this thread of similarity throughout, and there's lots of common things that we both agree on, that we both felt and still feel now. So this connection is great. It's almost like, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. At all. Yeah, well, it's very much like that, where at the beginning of the film, there's like all these different people who are like building these mud piles. They're creating like this mountain and stuff like that, and they don't know why. And so there's this, and then when they meet at the end, they're both, it's almost like that same thing where they're saying, yeah, I was creating that in my kitchen as well. So there's like this kind of thread of thought that we're all connected. And it's like, you're never looking for confirmation out of all this, but it's a feeling of affirmation. So it's always lovely to just connect with other people and chat about it. So yeah, I felt that and still feel it too. So as
this awakening was happening to you, you were recognizing you now had some artistic ability that you didn't have before. You felt you were being guided to paint. You were being guided to write some music to help express this experience that you had had. Is writing the book another finger in that hand, if you will? Is it another expression of that guidance you were receiving from wherever that was?
Yes, it is, yeah. And it's something that I would like to have done earlier, but I couldn't do because of I'm dyslexic. So it's taken some time to come. Well, I say it's taken some time. It wasn't something that I was thinking, I've got to get this book out, but it fell into place. So many things just kind of fall into place because they're meant to come out when they come out. So I think the music and the paintings were meant to come together first to support the book, which is now the next stage of the journey. And so it's not, obviously I'm excited about the book coming out, but it's been really exciting promoting it as well, like talking to people like yourself and being able to sort of spread the word through word of mouth now, me talking about it more to people and having the music and the art there for people to be able to look at afterwards has been great. I've done interviews and then people get back to me the next day and say, oh, I heard your interview. Then I went to your website and I enjoyed the music and the paintings, and it gave it even more of a dimension of what you were talking about. So they're all different. They're just different mediums and different dimensions to be able to talk about this and to express to people that there's nothing to fear of death itself,
That was going to be my next question. There are three things, and I'm going to ask them individually and maybe get some short answers to this, but how did the experience change your attitude toward religion?
Oh, right, yeah. Well, that was just like instantly from that moment when I saw that huge tunnel of white light, then my faith completely changed. And I believe in God, and I believe in a creator. Yeah, my faith is very powerful, and keeps me going, and Christ as well. That came later. I continued to have spiritual healing. Well, I still do to this day, actually, and I remember having early on at some point when I was having one of my spiritual healing sessions that I used to see a lot of images while I was being healed of light coming in still from above. And then there was one healing session that I literally saw an image of Christ while I was being healed.
Oh, wow.
And it was really, and he just looked great. He just looked really healthy and powerful and beautiful and just kind of floating above me. So I came, that the session had finished or what have you. And then one of the mediums who was healing me had turned around to me and said, you know what? Christ was stood right next to you when I saw him when I was healing you. I was going, no way. I was going, I just saw him as well. So I thought, right, this is it. I've got to go. And it hadn't entered my head that Christ had existed until that point, because I didn't suddenly turn to the Bible or anything. Yes, I mean, it wasn't like I'd become any other. I hadn't become Christian or Muslim or any other faith. It was just that I believed in God. But then I thought, no, now I believe in Christ because he was there. And he was obviously there at the time and I needed him to honor his healing. So I actually painted him. So that's one of the paintings that if people are interested in looking, then you'll see that's exactly what I saw, that vision of him floating above me. Yeah.
What about death? How has this changed your attitude toward death?
Well, it's the way I see death is you know, yeah, okay, the body dies, but the soul continues on. It's the next stage of the journey. You know, it's not like a light switch that just goes off like that, and there's nothing to fear at all. I mean, I don't fear it. I don't fear death now at all. It's I just know that it's the next stage of the journey, and it's quite a beautiful stage of the journey as well.
And those might be the two obvious ones, but this might be the most important one. How has that experience changed your attitude toward life?
Well, interestingly enough, that I actually look at life as being heaven on earth. The earth itself is a really beautiful place, and I didn't realize just how beautiful it was. In fact, it was funny, because after my NDE, I became fascinated with watching documentaries and all about astronauts, you know, because they're going out to the space and hanging out in the universe. I wanted to see what their take on it was, you know. And I found that quite a few astronauts, they're scientists, they're big-time scientists, but they were like, a few of them were turning around saying when they came back that they gained faith. You know, it changed their whole outlook on, mm-hmm. on more, not mortality, but a few of them actually said, when they came back to Earth, they said it was like, as you come back from the moon, which is like this big dusty white sort of, planet or whatever, you know, and that you come back to Earth and it's all these colors and all these beauties, heaven, it's like heaven on Earth, you know, as you come back. And so exactly, I agree with you. You know, so I feel that life is you know, it's we've got to reassess how well we've been given the opportunity right now to reevaluate life and the planet all around us. Everyone's talking about here anyway about how they're enjoying listening to birdsong and nature's completely starting to live on alongside us a lot more now, because the whole world has suddenly had to slow down. You know, so. Yeah.
If you had an opportunity, and you may have, you probably have actually had an opportunity to sit with someone who is close to death or dying, what words would you give them?
I'd say don't be scared, but don't have no fear, and just go with it. You know, I'm not saying let go and don't hang on to life, but just don't be fearful of it. There's nothing to fear, and. You know what, I actually did a thing here. Actually, I was contacted by a newspaper called The Guardian, which is kind of quite a big paper in the UK. One of the journalists actually has got a very big fear of death. And so she wanted to make this film all about it. And so I was one of the people that she interviewed. And I could see she was clearly terrified of death to the point that she couldn't sleep at night sometimes thinking about it. So, you know, I just showed all my paintings and talked about my music and stuff, and I explained the whole thing that, you know, that it's my mother passed away last summer, and I mean, you know, it really helped me to know that she'd gone on to a beautiful place and that she was being released and she got Alzheimer's, and so she was free of that and she was in a lovely place. So it's not only good to be able to help people overcome fear of death, but also when they've just lost their loved ones, to be able to turn around and say, look, don't worry, you know, your yeah. father or mother is in a good place. It's not the end. You haven't lost them forever. That, you know, they're probably still around you now.
Yeah, that's important. Okay, so the book is called Shine On, and it's available June 26th, although it is available for pre-order now. Let everybody know where the website is. You said you have an Instagram. Let people know where they can follow you there and anything else you want folks to know about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you want to listen to the music as well, just go to the website as well, and you'll find the links to my SoundCloud page, and so you can stream that for free, and so you can hear that very first symphony that I talked about, which is called The Divine Light, and then that piece of music says it all, really. It talks about the whole journey of the near-death experience that I had.
It's been a fascinating discussion, David. Best of luck with the book. I can tell it's important for you to get this message out and have people understand your experience and get some inspiration from it. I think that's a lot of what you're after, and based on what you've told us here, I can see why that's important to you.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. Yeah, and One thing I can actually add as well, but thinking about it, that in August, I've been invited to take part. This is a US-based thing, but it's a worldwide annual summit. So it's the third near-death experience summit, which takes part the 1st and the 2nd of August. So if people want to try and look that up online, there's some great speakers, other people who have had NDEs themselves and experts in this field. So please have a look at that if you're interested in looking into near-death experiences.
Terrific. David, thank you so much for getting up early and braving the early morning hours to be with us. It's much, much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Once again, just in case you didn't get it, the website is shineonthestory.com, and David Ditchfield was our guest.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.